on the Bible study, and today's session is to deal with acting in history, to shape history, but because of some material I was going to use was used earlier, I'm going to emphasize mourning, creating a new reality out of a tough situation. We're going to reflect on Job. What we've been doing this week is reflecting on scriptural experiences and then bringing our own experience or our own stories to those experiences and trying to draw out ways of living that from the interaction of biblical experience in our own experience. And today we want to reflect on Job and his experience from prosperity to desperation to prosperity again. It's kind of a fairy table with a bad downturn in it. last session surprised me and some of the things that came out in the end, and I got some real good inspiration for some of the things I'm involved in from it, and maybe that'll happen again today with us here. So in light of this, maybe we can reflect for a few minutes on God's presence with us here, realizing God's love and presence as we individually are created with gifts and callings, in relationship to God and to our families and to our communities. And in God's presence, in light of what we're going to be about, maybe you can recall times when you were desperate or you were working with desperate people who seemed to be victims of unjust circumstances and what that felt like to you. Maybe there were times when you were blamed for being a victim. What did being blamed for those desperate circumstances mean to you? And how did you live with that and deal with it? What new reality came out of that experience for you? Thank you. Can we turn to the first chapter of Job? And I'm going to try to do this in a way that recalls for us what happened in this Job story without reading too much of it. But there's some elements I'll try to hit, and so our reflection can get into the various dimensions of this experience. So can somebody read chapters 1 and 2, start it off, and then I'll go from there.
There was a man in the land of Uz.
Uz? There's going to be a number of names in there. Don't let them stop you. Just plow right through them.
That man was blameless. One who feared God and turned away from evil. There were born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He had 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 she-asses, and very many servants. So that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. His sons used to go and hold a feast in the city of each on his day, and they would send and invite their three sisters to eat and drink with them. And when the day of the feast had run their course, Job would send and sanctify them. And he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. So Job said, "It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did continually. There came a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, "Whence have you come?" Satan answered the Lord, "From going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil?" Then Satan answered the Lord, "Does Job fear God for naught? Hast thou not put a hedge about him and his house and all that he has on every side? Thou hast blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But put forth thy hand now and touch all that he has, and he will curse thee to thy face." And the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your power. Only upon himself do not put forth your hand." So Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord. Now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house, and there came a messenger to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the asses feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans fell upon them and took them and slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was speaking, there came another and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you." Well, while he was yet speaking, there came another, and he said, "The Chaldeans formed three companies and made a raid upon the camels and took them and slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was speaking, there came another and said, "Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house, and behold, a great wind came across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house and fell upon the young people, and they are dead, and I alone have escaped to tell you." Then Job arose and went and rent his robe, and shaved his head, and fell upon the ground, and worshipped. And he said, "Naked I come before my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong.
You can go on, or somebody else could read chapter 2.
Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves to Job. Satan also came among them and to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, "Well, whence have you come?" And Satan answered the Lord, "From going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it." The Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil? He still holds fast his integrity, although you moved against him, so destroy him without cause." Although you moved against him to destroy him without cause. Then Satan answered the Lord, "Skin for skin, all that a man has he will give for his life. But put forth thy hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse thee to thy face." And the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, he is in your power. Only spare his life." So Satan went from the presence of the Lord and afflicted Job with loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took a potsherd with which to scrape himself and sat among the ashes. Then his wife said to him, "You still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die." But he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good at the hand of God? And shall we not receive evil?" In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Now when Job's three friends heard of all this evil that had come down upon him, they came each from his own place. Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Hugh Hyde and Bill Carr, the Amber type. And they made an appointment together to come to condole with him and comfort him. And when they saw him from afar, they did not recognize him, and they raised their voices and wept. And they rent their robes and sprinkled dust upon their heads toward heaven. And they sat down with him on the ground 7 days and seven nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his suffering was very great.
Thanks, Mark. I'm going to try to hit a couple of high points in the next several chapters. What we've seen here is that the pride of God's eye, Job, a faithful servant, is allowed to be thrashed about and grinded under by Satan, by evil forces. And Job has remained faithful so far. And so now we switch from God allowing this to happen to his faithful servant to what happens between Job and his friends and others, and what a quandary this gives to his friends, because they too have wealth. And so if Job can suffer with his wealth in this way, what's to prevent that from happening to Job's friends? And so that's the struggle that goes on. So I'll read a few parts just to give you a sense of this. And the first one would be chapter 4, verses 1 to 9. Then Eliphaz the Themanite answered, "If one ventures a word with you, will you be offended? But who can keep from speaking? See, you have instructed many. You have strengthened the weak hands. Your words have supported those who were stumbling, and you have made firm the feeble knees. But now it has come to you, and you are impatient. It touches you, and you are dismayed. Is not your fear of God your confidence, and the integrity of your ways your hope? Think now, who that was innocent ever perished? Or where were the upright cut off? As I have seen, those who plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the same. By the breath of God they perish, and by the blast of his anger they are consumed." So Job, think, what have you done that's wrong that has brought this terrible thing upon you? Then in chapter 8, verses 1 to 7, Bildad the Shuhite answered, "How long will you say these things, and the words of your mouth be a great wind? Does God pervert justice? Or does the Almighty prevent the right? If your children sinned against him, he delivered them into the power of their transgression. If you will seek God and make supplication to the Almighty, if you are pure and upright, surely then he will rouse himself for you and restore to you your rightful place. Though your beginning was small, your latter days will be very great. Surely, Job, there's sin in your house. You know, supplicate God and all will be restored." And in chapter 11, verses 1 to 7, then Zophar the Naamathite answered, "Should a multitude of words go unanswered? And should one full of talk be vindicated? Should your babble put others to silence? And when you mock, shall no one shame you? For you say, my conduct is pure, and I am clean in God's sight. But oh, that God would speak and open his lips to you, and that he would tell you the secrets of wisdom. For wisdom is many-sided. Know that the God exacts of you less than your guilt deserves." It goes on with a lot of rhetorical type statements and questions and so forth. And finally, God in chapter 38 speaks to Job. Job was asking for a face-to-face encounter with God. And in chapter 38 through 40, God speaks out of a whirlwind to Job and reflects on the powers of God, the gifts of God, the ways of God, and and then concludes in chapter 42. So, somebody like to read chapter 42?
Then Job answered the Lord, I know that thou canst do all things, and that no purpose of thine can be thwarted. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Hear, and I will speak. I will question you, and you declare to me. I have heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees thee. Therefore I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. After the Lord had spoken these words to Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, My wrath is kindled against you and against your two friends, for you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. Now therefore take seven bulls and seven rams and go to my servant Job, and offer up for yourselves a burnt offering, and my servant Job shall pray for you, for I will accept his prayer not to deal with you according to your folly. For you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. So Eliphaz the Temanite and Bildad the Shuhite and Zophar the Nephethite went and did what the Lord had told them, and the Lord accepted Job's prayer. And the Lord restored the fortunes of Job, and when he had prayed for his friends, and the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. Then came to him all his brothers and sisters and all who had known him before, and ate bread with him in his house. And they showed him sympathy and comforted him for all the evil that the Lord had brought upon him. And each of them gave him a piece of money and a ring of gold. And the Lord blessed the latter days of Job more than his beginning. And he had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camels, 1,000 yoke of oxen, and 1,000 she asses. He had also 7 sons and 3 daughters, and he called the name of the first Jemimah, and the name of the second Keziah, and the name of the third Kernahapuk. And in all the land there were no women so fair as Job's daughters. And their father gave them inheritance among their brothers. And after this Job lived 140 years, and saw his sons and his sons' sons 4 generations. And Job died an old man and full of days.
It's quite a story. Are there any initial reactions to the story that people like to... I like the...
It's never too late.
It's never too late. I like God's way of restoring.
That's what I was thinking, yeah. I don't think it's possible to restore. I think after you've lost the people you love, the people that come that you love follow them, you don't replace them.
Yeah.
I thought that too. I thought, yes, he got back, but the 7 children who died, as a parent.
Mm-hmm.
You don't ever replace that.
I don't even think it deals with that issue here, does it?
No. No, but that was my first thought when I read that. I thought,
yeah,
it doesn't bring back the 7 children he lost.
From my understanding of the Old Testament, though, it falls in line with the mentality of possessions. The male owned asses and goats, kids and wife.
Yeah.
You know, from that angle.
Yeah.
It's in keeping with the Old Testament mentality, but you know, you don't replace your lost children and spouses. I don't remember. She was there in the beginning, and
yeah,
you know, encouraging Job to, you know,
deny God,
right?
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting too that his friends are more interested in justifying themselves than they are in helping him through his trouble. They want him to agree that he must have done something terrible because otherwise they're at risk.
Yeah, I think that's a key point to the whole story. Is the last couple of days we've been talking about the relationship with ourselves and God, but learning that according to the prophetic view and Christ view, our relationship to God depends on our relationship with each other. And here they're trying to rationalize their own existence.
Doesn't do him much good, do you? Mm-hmm.
But in the end, isn't their point made, in a sense? Because he remained true, he remained upright, and he got everything back.
But was that their point when they were arguing with him?
Well, I'm just thinking that when you think of that mentality that says it's my works that gets me my wealth,
mm-hmm.
my riches,
mm-hmm.
In the end, that's what happened.
It was Job's faithfulness that God rewarded. But what I heard the friend saying is, Job, your kids sinned and you sinned. And you're not owning up to that. You know, that's why you're suffering all this, you know, misfortune, is because you have sinned.
Well, that's what they thought, but we know that that's not the case, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the Lord...
That's what the story tells us, right?
But you're saying it was justified in their eyes, is that what you're saying?
In the end, yeah, his friends were...
but the Lord comes down very heavily against them in the end, and says that his anger is kindled against these three friends that were trying to tell him that it was because he had sinned that he was suffering.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the final story on that is that is not, you know, innocent suffering cannot be related one-on-one to the sin of the
mm-hmm.
And the Lord, in essence, is rewarding Job and not the...
He's correcting the friends, isn't he?
Telling
them to bring this gift to Job as a way of making up.
Well, but wasn't it the friends that in fact had sinned against God because of their relationship to Job? Because they didn't believe that Job mm-hmm. had been upright. They wouldn't mm-hmm. believe him.
So you're saying that's a sin on the part of the friends?
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't hear you say that earlier. Yeah.
And so...
they were sinning against God and against Job, in a sense, by...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It doesn't have a lot to do with how we are instructed to treat our friends and our those in relationship with in their time of trouble. What he needed was compassion, and what he got was advice.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we can draw out here is, you know... when we were in this situation, what was it like? Or when we knew others, how did we react or interact?
And isn't that the difference that Christ was trying to make? I mean, he was a Christ of compassion,
mm-hmm.
regardless of the convention of the day
mm-hmm.
that you needed to be holy, regardless of compassion. His was saying you need to be compassionate, regardless of whether or not what you're doing appears to be holy.
Mm-hmm. Can you think of situations that you're involved in or know about that this, you know, this type of activity happens? Not talking about the compassion side, but, you know, mm-hmm. people that are suffering.
I suppose we do that almost routinely. But we don't address the needs of others because... it doesn't exactly fit into, I even think of even a worship service. You know, there's those people that say it has to be this way, regardless of how that might affect others.
Mm. It's not very compassionate.
It isn't very compassionate.
Mm. Can you give an example of that? Something happened. Worship. Insensitive worship service is what
yeah.
you're saying. That
yeah.
something was said, some reading or some
song. Or even I look at the churches that we construct that are in many cases not very accessible. You know, you look at all the steps up the front and you know, how the handicapped people get in and out, how the elderly people get in and out. That's
mm-hmm.
not really very compassionate
mm-hmm.
because it's limiting access. But that's the way it was done.
That seems to be, to me, in a sense, making victim, although it's not a huge issue, it's a significant issue. It's making a victim, but of people by that act. But what I was trying to get at, people that we know who have been victimized by something or someone, and what happens in that circumstance. I mean, there's a lot of examples in society. I'm hoping you'll bring some of your experiences with that up.
Isn't that true, like in cases of rape? Quite often the victim, people look at them and say, she must have done something. She must have, you know, they're never held guiltless.
Mm-hmm.
Even like in a court, a lot of times a jury will be biased against the victim in that type of a situation, because people feel like something must have been done by that person to bring that victimization on themselves, which is not the case.
I've heard of and read about a lot of cases like that, but I've never firsthand, you know, observed anything like that or seen it. But that's, I hear that a lot.
I think of children too. Abused children. Is it because of the way they acted that they were beaten?
Mm-hmm.
And we see a lot of kids like that in school that are victims.
Well, and the children believe that too.
Mm-hmm.
They believe that they must have done something.
That is
so they start to believe that.
The difference between an adult and a child is significant in that regard. You know, people like Bradshaw, the whole mentality of a child is to look to the adult, especially a parent or a teacher, as, you know, quasi-God, you know, and you know, they have all the answers. And if there's something they're upset about, it's because I just don't know how to act. So that's a very significant point for kids.
Well, in some ways that makes it easier for the person to handle it, though. I mean, we're brought up when you do something wrong, there is a reaction to it. There's mm-hmm. a consequence that happens. So when you're involved in one of those situations, if you can pick up the thing that you did wrong, then it makes it easier to explain it. I was involved in a situation similar to this where I made a mistake. I went up to a person that I didn't know in a situation I should not have done it. Mm-hmm. And I found that afterwards that tended to be my focus, was that was stupid. And not that you were asking for it necessarily, but you should have known better than to walk up to someone that you didn't know. And to focus on that part of it just made it feel like there was, well, it empowers the person to feel like, well, if I change, if I don't do that, then it won't happen again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I found that other people did the same thing. We all tended to focus on that one mistake that was made instead of
the victim.
Yeah.
No mention of the person that's victimizing.
So often in abusive situations, you know, with husband and wife, it's been shown that, you know, there's nothing the wife can do to please, et cetera, et cetera, that's going to make the abuse stop. And once again, but people will say, well, what was she doing wrong, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Pointing in a misguided way, looking for a supposed sin that would bring down the suffering upon her, instead of looking at the person that's perpetrating the violence and saying, this needs to stop, this is an evil.
Mm-hmm.
That seems like a human quality that is repeated and repeated and repeated. And the thing with the story is telling us the victim who has the center, a grasp of the center of things, in other words, God, in this case, is not ever a victim in reality.
In reality.
But it's like a story that goes back to ancient times. And this story is repeated over and over and over again. The good and the evil decide to test.
Mm-hmm.
And,
to this day.
And here is, you know, here is Job. You know, he's the king, essentially. The archetype.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying that into it now. But here he is. And if he loses the center of things, he's lost. But he just holds on to the center. He remains the king. He gets his kingdom back. He's in middle age, let's say, and he loses his wife, his job, you know, everything. He divorces, loses his business, and he can disappear down on Bright Street, or disappear. Or somehow to the center. I think that's what the story's about.
Do you see it as if then related that if he keeps the center, he then will be rewarded?
I think that's what the story is.
To have the material possessions restored was a mark of being in favor with God. But that does not always happen, and that is not what, you know, hopefully we would necessarily look on as a mark of restored favor.
If you look at the 12-step approach, for instance, and I don't know what step it is, but it says you have to recognize the supreme need, to give up.
That's the first step. Recognize your powerlessness over the addiction or whatever, you know, has you think it has you can be empowered over, and that
will it to a higher power.
Higher power, yeah. Right? Yeah.
And what more? You know, how, I can't think of more victims than the people that enter into that support kind of system that you can. Trying to figure out how to get out systems of abuse.
I don't think Job ever lost his connection with his higher power in this. He was desperate and in misery through a lot of it, but he never lost that connection in this whole thing. And what he wanted was a face-to-face encounter with God. Why the hell am I going through this, you know? And probably a lot of anger. But, you know, this isn't that refined a story, but you can project a little bit of that in there. But it seems that Job maintained his relationship, and then according to Old Testament mentality, he was restored. I don't think in our lives, and that's what I think you're saying, we don't experience that. I've never had the wealth to begin with, but but wealth in another sense of you know, good family and so forth. It doesn't always happen that way.
Maybe that's the whole message, though, is that regardless of what's happening in life, don't lose that connection.
I think there are a lot more messages to that. If people see Christ through Christians, then the message for us is, what is the gratitude? And what should they have done? And why were they blaming the victim? Because I think that's, societally, that's what we do. For me right now, that the loggers in our community are the victims that are being villainized. And it's very clear-cut and simple to anyone on the other side of the issue that they are at fault. We could just get rid of them every moment in time. And yet there are people like everyone else who have invested their life savings in their work based on what they consider to be a promise of the government in terms of harvest. And now they've not only lost their equipment, but they're losing their vehicles, their homes, and of course through that their families. And yet any cartoon that you see, political cartoon, they're stereotyped a certain way.
I planted you.
You should have told me.
Yeah. And I'd like to go on from there. I think you summarized it in a good way, but I'd like to go on because as an example of this kind of experience, whether it's with some like the rape victims or welfare victims or abuse victims of many types, the blaming is happening. But I think what we should do to reach out, I'm working with Lutheran churches and communities in these logging areas, just starting to, and we're planning a conference the end of September to think about what is happening there and what can we do to come up with a compassionate approach. And so I can read, which some, you know, elaborates a little bit on what you said, and then we can talk about response and our response, what is appropriate for our response in these circumstances. Bearing in mind what I think you're saying, the ordinary human approach is to point fingers and blame. That's a natural reaction with, you know, couldn't you think ahead? Couldn't you avoid dressing this way or that way? You know, so you wouldn't be a victim. This is a quote from Bob Lee, who's a sociologist from the University of Washington, done a fair amount of work with logging communities in the sense of, he works with the Department of Forestry, and he's interviewed a lot of the families, he and his associates. And this is just one point. There's a lot of points to make on this. The popular press and some environmental protection groups have characterized loggers as primitive, overweight, beer-drinking, not-so-intelligent laborers with little regard for the future. This has been most prevalent in Earth First literature, newspaper columns, political cartoons, advertisement, and serial cartoons such as The Far Side, although letters to the editor of various newspapers reveal similar negative stereotypes are widespread among members of the general public. Most importantly, loggers and other woods workers have come to see themselves as being categorized as heathen tree killers or rural bumpkins. Other stereotypes characterize old-growth logging as an obsolete occupation, referring to loggers as horseshoers or the last of the buffalo hunters. The latter metaphor is especially effective at dehumanizing the logger because it connotes greedy disregard for the future and creates a negative emotional association with logging that extends to logging in all forests. Such stereotyping is classic of blaming the victim, attributing to individuals pathological character traits that explain why they are suffering. Lee finds parallels between negative stereotyping of loggers and the nation's historic treatment of blacks. Our history of race relations has taught us that negative stereotypes serves the political function of dehumanizing people so that they can be exploited or treated unfairly. In this case, removed from the land. We have also learned it has predictable human consequences for the victims. Self-blame, loss of self-esteem, personal disempowerment undermine the ability of people to take pride in themselves and their capabilities, fight back, demand respect, and equal treatment. Such stereotyping can attribute to learned helplessness, depression, cynicism, and passivity, a self-fulfilling prophecy for continued disempowerment. So think of you being that circumstance, or others you know being that circumstance, and what's the best way to reach out? You know, what's the Christ way? Our understanding of Christ's way to reach out in those circumstances. Think of the way I understand, I'm learning a lot of this. I'm not from a logging community. I worked in the inner city a lot of places and stuff. But my perception is that a lot of the Lutheran and Christian churches are made up of members not necessarily from the logging community. The majority are not from the logging community. So they're saying, we care We want to help. How do you connect with, in a vital way, people who are going through what loggers and their families are going through? How do you connect with them? How do you form relationship that with these victims who are experiencing some degree or other of anger, being victimized, depression, cynicism, what's in other words, helplessness, passivity. Somebody did this in your community, or how did that happen? You know.
I don't know, but I think it's wonderful. Mm-hmm. I'm really glad to see that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real small community down there in the Columbia Gorge.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one.
Yeah, I have found support groups for me in certain circumstances being helpful. You know, but, you get to share with others going through the same. Experience. Mm-hmm.
But when you're in those kind of relationships, what you realize after a very short while, it isn't a short-term affair.
Yeah.
That you can't say, bless you, my son, and move on.
Yeah.
We happen to be in kind of a unique situation. We taught a class on listening, how to listen. And it got more and more and more involved, but it was listening in relation to parenting, how to listen to your children. And it so happened that one of the sets of parents there were the logger and wife and kids, and the logger was trying to go through a change from being a logger to a builder. And it was kind of essentially a year-long thing. And in the class, because of the nature of the class, we were able to listen to the wife and the husband just talk about all of the difficulties and all of the hurts and all of the inequities and all, you know, just the whole thing. And it took a long, 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 long time. And I'm saying, if anybody wanted to do it, you know, it's a full-time affair, in a sense. So you got to listen to them. You got to be careful about saying, yes, I hear you, and not being judgmental. And the case that we did, we're working with, this guy turned out to be a Cracker Jack lover. All of the difficulties that we went through at the state level and people calling them, the rape and run logger. Our situation is probably unique, but I guess my only comment is a focus on it. It requires lots of energy.
It's not just, let's get together and fix it and take apart. Do you recall how you or members of the group established the initial relationship with the loggers? What got you together so that that could happen?
First of all, it wasn't targeted to loggers. It was targeted to the parent. He just happened to be a logger in transition.
Mm-hmm.
And our focus was teaching people how to listen very carefully and gently, not only to the words, but to the feelings, to the expressions, and trying to get people to talk about, listen to what people are really talking about, getting behind the words and all that sort. And with him, we just happened to hit upon him and his family.
It's a matter of telling the story, what it was about, your parents were on the
So there's some kind of meeting set up?
It was a Sunday school class.
Sunday school class among parents, huh? Oh, okay. So that was sort of a neutral ground and on a a subject that concerned everybody.
Yeah, it could be if that group had been focused, those in this class also, that might not have occurred, but because we were focusing on the joint problems of parenting, but starting off with listening to each other, that was, you know, it's a very neutral ground where I think both of them felt comfortable to share lots of different things.
Mm-hmm.
That may, they may not have had been a different or very distinct focus on.
I wonder if, as a church body, if, you know, just in this discussion, I think of two things. Number one, that we do, we are obligated to be concerned about issues, but we need to separate people from issues. You know, the thing with the loggers, the thing, my generation, the Vietnam vets who were blamed for all the political feelings about Vietnam, you know, it wasn't their fault. They were drafted, you know. You know, we do that so often. We want to blame a person for an issue. And instead of working on the issue and, mm-hmm. and like keeping blame off people. And then I think, largely because of what you were saying, that this just happened, I think it establishes that as a community of believers, we need to be together, we need to be talking. We need to be in Sunday school, we need to be fellowshipping at potluck dinners. We need to constantly create those opportunities to listen and be there. I went through a real difficult situation about 3 years ago, which hasn't ended. But I found for about 3 months everybody was there. Well, my situation hasn't ended.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of people right there, right at first.
Mm-hmm.
And then they disappear. You know, and I think, and so for me, what I have found is that I need that constant fellowship of believers. I need to be in God's Word, I need to be growing, I need to be sharing with other Christians and keeping my perspective. And that's when those opportunities come. When the one person in the place you least expect it is the person who's going to know how to help you.
Mm-hmm.
Or you are going to be able to be used of God to help.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It only happens if we're out there. You know, it doesn't happen if we're home behind locked doors.
But it seems like not only do you have to be out there, but I just sensed all the way through Job, where Job himself is a real sense of honesty.
Mm-hmm.
And if we meet with each other and talk with each other, we have to be honest with each other.
Yeah.
If I'm grieving, I would like to be able to be in a place where I can just talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you're grieving, I can hear your grief. And if it's more than just weather, or,
yeah.
you know, kids' grades in school or something.
Yeah.
I think that's an element.
Well, there's another thing that bothers me a little, and that's that what has happened in this situation, you know, even though we're villainizing the victim, there are lots of things that are involved here that don't make that person altogether, you know, blameless, let's say. There are values in here in the situation that are in conflict, and they're going to remain in conflict because we need to resolve that in some way that will satisfy us all. But by making the victims the villains, they have to come back twice as strong adversarially. And
they go off and die.
Either one.
Emotionally or
right.
physically. Yeah.
They're, you know, they go through the same mm-hmm. steps as the alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're tremendously angry
mm-hmm.
and in denial.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as that isn't dealt with somehow, then they continue to press forward on a self-destructive path. And I don't care whether they're the radical environmentalist or the victimized logger. The same thing happens. How do we break that? And I noticed in here in Joel that the footnote says, call Satan, who's the player in here, the adversary.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we do to each other. We get into these adversarial roles, and we know we're right, and by God, we're going to show this other person how wrong they are, just like the friends did.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to break that.
Don't you think part of what happened in our group, a church which started parenting and began progressing towards what you were, these guys were trying to rename it at the end, just a support, a family support situation where when we connect as people, those other things tend to fall away instead of the issues out front. And as I was thinking, you're talking, you know, our friend the logger, we also had the situation where out of the blue that one day where we had a grandmother who was suddenly feeling totally useless. Mm-hmm. Nobody wanted her anymore. And all of a sudden out of this class came this incredible need that at that moment we would have not ever have been aware of if it wasn't an open forum just to connect as people. And that's where we noticed that in, we have a fairly large congregation, that there was not a place for that. We have all our meetings, we have the youth groups, and we have our Sunday school classes, but there was not a place for people to care and share as people. And if it wasn't, and some of us have become kind of addicted to this group now, you feel like you get through the week, there is a time when you can sit down and even, and just connect on a deeper level that had never occurred before. And that had been missing. And all of these, and I find when I was, we were talking with the logger or the grandmother or something, that the issues melt away and you begin to deal as people.
As people.
And we need to do that first, because then the other things come much more into perspective.
And something new comes out of it.
Always.
You don't anticipate all the new stuff that's going to come out. Some of it you hope is going to be there.
If we can do this within a community of believers, but it's kind of hard to get it started, you know, to even think about doing it, how do you reach people that aren't within a community of believers, that are out, you know, that have kept themselves outside of fellowship and community?
We struggle with that in many ways.
Yeah.
One thing that's happening in our community is that because of some of the timber relief money and some of the retraining and all of that, one of the things that's just started is a support group for unemployed, underemployed people making a transition. And it happens to be in the Baptist church in our community where mm-hmm. that particular part is going on.
Mm-hmm.
And there are just a whole lot of things going on. And my opinion is that we Christians are already doing that in a lot of ways, and we should be encouraged to do it more. We come in, we get fed, and we have a responsibility to be a part of that. And I don't think we have to go in there saying, you know, praise God, here I come. You say that inside yourself, but what you do is you offer that kind of loving compassion and ability to listen or whatever it is that's needed within that setting. And that, I know people who have done that and have caused a change in the person's life that then brings them to Christ. Maybe it doesn't.
Yeah.
They've still done what Christ asked for them to do.
Do. And that's the key point. I think that the experience you did internally to a congregation to set up things like parenting classes or reflecting on the Bible, inviting people to draw their story out, whether they're little kids or families, single-parent families, you know, draw out stories within. But when you get to going outside the congregation to other groups, then either have to go out to them or invite them to something in the congregation that they might be willing. And I, in the first session here, somebody gave me something to take back to this process we're talking about, because I was, you know, if I were a member of the Lutheran congregation going out to people in the community, in the logging community, I come with a lot of tools and a lot of resources and probably a whole lot of answers to your problem. Mm-hmm. And that can happen. You know, we send out people, you know,
fix it,
mm-hmm. quick, with the answers. And this person brought in the Christ sending the disciples out with nothing. Mm-hmm. Just go out and invite yourself into a home like Jesus invited himself into people's homes and just have tea. You know.
Yeah.
I thought that was, to me, a great image. Leave all your answers at home and listen and form relationship, you know, and then the new thing. What that does for the person going out is to put them at risk, put me or you at risk, but makes you more honest, more humble, more real. What that does for the person that you're talking to is breaking through all this stuff about being the victim and depressed, and you know, you recognize that, you know, they have a certain amount of power, even if the only power is to give you a cup of tea and share, you know, some views with you. And that really appealed to me, that whole image of going out with nothing, and forming a relationship. Then you can bring your tools later on,
yeah,
as the other person brings his or her tools into it. You know.
My husband brought home a quote out of one of these little desk calendars that the kids got, and it said, be careful how you live your life. You may be the only Bible some people ever read.
Mm.
And it's really true when we start to treat people with compassion and not as villains, but trying to see their point.
Well, you know, I'm certainly not going to argue against compassion, and I don't think I'm going to argue for blaming, but I'm not quite willing to say, you know, that adversarialness is necessarily wrong either, you know, and I don't think that we were either. The fight against the destruction of the forests is
mm-hmm.
a critical fight,
mm-hmm.
and it's going to tear up people,
mm-hmm.
and I think that I was thinking of the Vietnam veterans as you said it. Well, you know, my recollection of that struggle was, all these soldiers that got spit on when they returned, I'd like to see them all line up and count them, because I think that was it.
There's thousands of them in our forest fighting out still.
That were spit on?
That field that they were
spit on. The field that they were spit on, but that's a different thing, and I think that, you know,
but
I think that, to me, that war was extraordinarily evil, and it destroyed millions of people in death and in killing, and that, you know, that I'm not pure in any sense by virtue of having opposed the war and having escaped the draft. But that certainly doesn't mean that the soldier that went over there and perhaps did mow down cruelly, viciously, women and children is innocent just because he was sent there against his will or in his ignorance. I mean, there were a lot of soldiers over there doing horrible things, even above and beyond what they were sent there to do. Now, those soldiers didn't all get killed there. Some of them, I would suggest, are probably up in the hills, living with their pain that was not brought about because they were perfectly virtuous people like Job is supposed to be, but because, my God, they killed people for no good reason at all. They slept with women and bore children that suffered forever, and that, you know, they were undisciplined and war criminals. Not to say that every one of them are. No, not at all. There were, I'm so aware that I could have so easily been one of the victimized soldiers over there. But, you know, all victims in the world aren't blameless by any means. You know, and we need adversarialness. We need struggle in which people get hurt very badly to change patterns of life that are very destructive. And we can't fight, and we can't stop those struggles just because people are going to get ground up in them, because people are going to get ground up without the struggle. And
so war is necessary.
So I think struggle is necessary, you know, painful, grinding struggle where all sorts of people get hurt, because that's the nature of the world, I think. You know, I mean,
it's the nature of change.
Yeah. Like in Eastern Europe, you see it now.
I mean, as change never smoothly, easily occurs, whether it be for good or bad.
Okay. And, you know, I mean, the tobacco farmers have, I mean, there's all sorts of industries which people find themselves in, not because they said, hey, I can just raise some tobacco, I can addict all these kids and kill them. You know, that wasn't how they got there, but you know, it's an evil industry in my mind.
But we need, our adversity has to be less hate-filled. It has to be with more compassion to the family, and I agree. I do agree. Yeah, the tobacco industry has to go, as far as I'm concerned. I've lost too many family members to lung cancer. But there are so many people there that it was the family farm, and he has been for 4 years. You don't come down on them with hate. You don't call them a murderer. You know, we have got to help people change. And I just think of New Testament teaching, and everything has to be, he said, love your enemies. He didn't say don't have enemies, but love your enemies. Don't hate them. Love them. And pray for those that persecute you.
But it doesn't say, you know, loving your enemies. You know, that a South African guy talks about that a lot, about, you know, in order to love your enemy, you have to identify him as an enemy.
Sure, yeah.
And you're not called to, well, I mean that's kind of a trick thing, you know. I mean, you know, we can't love our enemies if we say, hey, after all, no darn any enemies.
Yeah. But I don't think anybody's saying that. No. Okay. I think what we're saying is that if we simplify it too much on any side, in any one of the values that we come from, then the struggle will be no longer a loving struggle. And it's no longer a struggle that's going to be productive. It's going to be, once again, somebody wins and others lose. And as long as that's where we're headed.
There's loving your enemy, I don't know that that means that you don't win and lose in a whole lot of fights.
Well, we need to struggle for understanding and helping. Like if we, and I'm not from the mid. I'm not from this part of the country, although I do know some of the logging struggle. I'm not in the middle of it. But, and this is going to sound like a disgustingly naive oversimplification, but we have to find a way that it isn't loggers against environmentalists, that there is an understanding between both, that there's help for the loggers to make the necessary changes and for what needs to be done, but that they don't feel attacked, because you said it so much. If they're attacked, if we come at them and say, you guys are Satan incarnate, you know, that's who you are because of what you're doing. No, I'm the fifth generation that's lived on this mountain and done this and provided homes for half the United States. That's what I am. You know, is how the logger looks at it.